Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Move along, nothing to see here. Wall Street plays a little game of what? Me worry? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 16th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to tick off just a couple of things on my fingers here that have happened in, say, the last month, 6 weeks or so. Working roughly chronologically backward, the president of the United States shared highly classified information with the Russians. The director of the FBI was fired. A major piece of legislation affecting almost 20% of the American economy was first pulled off the House floor before a vote and then passed in the House by the slenderest of margins. Chaos has become the byword in political America. And yet, in headline economic America, it's all good. Insert here my customary warning about the Dow Jones not being the economy and the economy not being the Dow, which is still true. But in different times, I'll tell you what, any one of my list of items I just ticked off would have spooked traders to a fare thee well, which would have roiled the markets and which would thus have dollars to donuts changed the nature of the conversation happening in political America. So it's worth it to pause the chaos news for a minute here and ask, what did the markets know and when did they figure it out? Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishwar.
You know that feeling in a scary movie when everyone is acting like everything is fine and then you realize everything is not fine and something terrible is going to happen? That's kind of what Chris Lowe is feeling.
A week ago, it looked like Congress was close to settling healthcare reform.
Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial.
Now, forget about healthcare reform. We're trying to figure out whether the president leaked classified information.
And yet, markets have not fallen and measures of volatility are low. This, even though, Lowe says, the Fed has warned stocks are overvalued.
The markets are almost completely desensitized.
Julian Emanuel is U.S. equities and derivatives strategist for UBS.
You know, we really saw that in the wake of the results of the French election.
That result was actually good news for markets.
There was no reaction whatsoever.
It may be that there's just been so much drama that investors feel dead inside and just can't be bothered. But it may also be that behind all the drama, there's some solid corporate performance. Chris Bertelsen is chief investment officer at Avianz Capital Management.
Let's look at what earnings have done. We're averaging around 13% year-over-year growth in earnings.
And yes, it's true that markets have been rising in hopes of corporate tax reform and infrastructure spending. But despite the political soap opera in D.C., those haven't actually failed yet.
For now, I think there's enough people who feel that this too shall pass and their confidence still remains pretty high.
Then again, give it a few more weeks. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishwar for Marketplace.
There are reports today that Ford Motor Company is going to cut about 10% of its global workforce, 20,000 salaried employees mostly. Ford, to be clear, turned steady profits, but big shareholders want CEO Mark Fields to do something about the company's sagging stock price. Wherein lies Ford's peril? Because Fields has turned the company's focus to the future of transportation, but investors, well, they want their returns right the heck now. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that.
The way we think about cars is changing. Fast. Ride sharing, car sharing, self-driving cars. But so far, Ford still just makes them. Alan Baum is an automotive industry consultant in Michigan. He says for Ford to remain viable, that's got to change.
Ford and other automakers need to find a way to change their process so that they can make money not just when they sell the car, but as a service.
What will those services be? That's unclear. But CEO Mark Fields has created whole new divisions with names like Mobility Services. Ford says it isn't dumping all its money into those new areas right now, but Fields has held this is the future of the company. David Cole is with the Center for Auto Research. He says Ford has to react to current market demands and changing technology.
Companies like Ford are trying to be as smart and wise as they can
But what they're dealing with is an atmosphere that's got a lot of unpredictability in it, and that's not going to change for some time.
That has investors nervous and looking at their watches. Linda Lim teaches business strategy at the University of Michigan.
What I think the technological disruption has done is enhanced focus on short term.
Shareholders are watching every move, she says. They want to see if the future of cars is here or still coming, and who's going to control it? Tech companies, startups, or traditional automakers like Ford? I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
While the WannaCry ransomware attack continues, though, in much diminished form from the past couple of days, there is a related story playing out in the entertainment industry. Hackers are said to have stolen an upcoming Disney movie and are holding it for ransom. Deadline reports it's the new Pirates of the Caribbean film, the fifth in that extended franchise. CEO Bob Iger has reportedly told Disney employees he is not going to pay, but might it, if the stakes are high enough, make sense to cough it up? Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that one.
To pay or not to pay? That is the question.
Never, ever give in to ransomware.
Liviu Arsini is a threat analyst at Bitdefender.
If you give in once, probably hackers will come in again and again and try to extort money from you. You know, once there's blood in the water, definitely sharks will come.
And no one wants sharks. That don't pay up advice is what you're going to hear from law enforcement. And it's advice that a lot of experts are going to give in a situation like Disney's. Just don't negotiate with terrorists. But Stu Showerman from the cybersecurity training firm KnowBefore says when hackers have locked up your data, it's not always cut and dry.
It's a business decision.
There's a fate potentially worse than those circling sharks.
If you find that your backups failed, and you find that you have lost months of work, which would potentially even shut you down as an organization, it's a no-brainer to pay the ransom, and many people do.
The government says ransomware costs businesses millions of dollars each year. Simon Crosby from the security firm Bromium agrees that there's a time and a place an organization might have to consider paying. But he says it shouldn't come to that. A company should have everything properly backed up.
If they don't have backups, then I'd slap them about the head a few times and say, why not?
There may be a lot of businesses out there in need of that sharp reminder. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, chaos? What chaos? Another record high on the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Trump leaves Friday for his first overseas trip since taking office. Saudi Arabia, Israel, and then a G7 summit up in Italy. The president's diplomatic deal-making skills are going to get their first real test as he meets with both Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. David Horovitz is the editor of The Times of Israel. We got him on the phone from Jerusalem. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The Middle East is a place that requires some subtlety. Mr. Trump is not a subtle man, as we've learned. What's the mood over there as he gets ready for this trip?
Well, the first thing to say is that his predecessor was certainly subtle and was certainly committed to trying to make progress, but he didn't get anywhere. So the fact of non-subtlety, I don't think by definition means that you're doomed. In the few weeks that Trump has been in office, you know, he sent an envoy here who did a very good job. His name is Jason Greenblatt. He met with Israelis, he met with Palestinians. The Saudis are making, you know, some slightly encouraging noises. Trump thinks that he can do a deal. I don't think that he can, but I would be only too happy if he could prove all of us doubters wrong.
Is there a way that Mr. Trump's prowess in business, as you mentioned, his ability to do a deal, could help things along? He's stopping in Saudi Arabia first, as you know, and then coming to Jerusalem. Could he perhaps do what he does?
Look, the reality is that the sides are a long way apart, and it's a difficult deal at any time. And right now, you know, extremely hard to see that he can make progress. At the moment, the Palestinian leadership has a public that resists compromise. You've got an Israel that would like a deal if you could guarantee that it would hold into the long term. And like I say, that's very difficult.
What do you make of these reports that there are some mutterings that the Arab nations will make it, in essence, worth Israel's while if it delves back into the peace process, that there is economic opportunity to be had that might help with the Palestinian issue. What do you make of that?
Look, Netanyahu's line in the last year or so, the Israeli prime minister, has been exactly that. He's sort of founded this belief that the region can chivvy the Palestinians forward. So Netanyahu would like to believe that, yes, the Saudis can be part of a wider quilt, if you like, patchwork of relationships, and then in a climate of greater regional cooperation, there'll be encouragement for the Palestinians to compromise and maybe even pressure from the Arab world for the Palestinians to compromise. I'm not sure that that's extremely viable, but again, make a comparison with the last president. Barack Obama tried to get the Saudis to at least allow something like symbolic overflights by Israeli civilian airliners. Let them come into your airspace, you know, to save them time when they're traveling around the world. The Saudis wouldn't even go along with that. So maybe Trump will have a little bit more success.
Since I have you on the phone, one last thing. What is the reaction over there to the news from Washington last night, East Coast time, about the revelations Mr. Trump made in the Oval Office to the Russians?
Well, it's a very interesting series of articles and reports from an Israeli perspective, because Israeli-American intelligence cooperation is very, very close. There's very, very detailed exchange of information. It's one of the, you know, the key aspects of this very important relationship. There's military cooperation. There's all sorts of shared values and shared interests. There's a great deal of intelligence exchange. So we don't know the specifics of this story. We don't know what to believe and what not to believe. But you can be sure that the Israeli officials who are engaged in that aspect and involved in that aspect of the relationship with the United States are watching these reports very carefully.
David Horovitz, he is the editor of the Times of Israel. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
The economic situation in Venezuela, as we have reported regularly for the past number of years, has been bad, very bad, and is now simply collapsed. There were more street protests this week against socialist President Nicolas Maduro. Dozens of people have been killed overall, hundreds detained in the calls for new elections. Maduro's opponents say government incompetence has caused the economic chaos and the ensuing shortages as well. The BBC's Vladimir Hernandez has this update from the capital city, Caracas.
Young Venezuelans wearing masks, shouting their support for a 27-year-old man who was killed in one of the latest anti-government protests in Caracas. "You're a hero," they shout, as authorities take his body away. Miguel was shot in the chest during clashes with police. At least 39 people have died so far in the demonstrations, which have been taking place every day for more than a month.
These people are asking for fresh elections against President Nicolas Maduro. But this is an economy in crisis. The inflation rate is estimated to be at over 700%, and the economy is crashing.
"I'm angry because of the economic crisis," this man says. "I want to recover the country where I grew up," this woman says. And this young student says she doesn't want more young people dying in the protests. Venezuelans say the unrest is because the economy has collapsed. Medicine is in short supply. People are forced to queue for hours for even the most basic goods, like food, soap, and even toilet paper. And it's the poorest who have been hit hardest. Away from the protests, I went to one of Caracas's poorest areas to meet Jorge, who lost a kidney a week ago after he was shot at close range during one of the demonstrations. When I reached his home, he was watching a video, widely shared on social media, which showed the moment of death of Miguel. Jorge later told me that this had been the first time he had cried for years.
"We've got to keep fighting, but we need to find a better way because we're getting killed. It's guns against stones. It doesn't work. Look at me, for example. But there's no one in this country saying that they're okay, that they eat well. Everyone here has lost weight, and losing weight leads to more illness.
Jorge's future is far from certain. He can't work while he's recovering. And he is also now one of the many Venezuelans suffering from a desperate shortage of medicine. For the government, people like Jorge are simply part of a plot to topple President Nicolas Maduro. And despite the ongoing crisis, it doesn't seem likely that he will call for early elections anytime soon.
The BBC's Vladimir Hernandez in Caracas, Venezuela. Coming up.
Hey, I see you looking. Don't walk past me. Come on over. Come and talk to me.
Wait, you can see me? The Postal Service is hiring, but first, let's do the numbers. Kind of a mixed bag on Wall Street today, to be honest. Dow Industrials flat, down just 2 points, 20,979. The NASDAQ added 0.3%. That is 20 points, finished at 6169, the aforementioned new record. S&P 500 gave back just under 0.1%, about a point, 2400 on the nose. Economic data kind of mixed today as well. Manufacturing production in April was surprisingly high, highest in 3 years in point of fact, but home building took an unexpected decline. Did not hurt home builders, though. KB Home kicked up 0.2% today. Toll Brothers did about the same. Pulte Group took home an extra 0.1%. The WannaCry hack did not hold Microsoft hostage. See what I did there? Tech giant logged a gain of more than 1%. You know its computers have that patch installed, right? Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Things have been not great in American retail of late. Since October, retail has lost 89,000 jobs, more, just for some context here, than work in steel or in coal mining in this country. Told you that so we could tell you this. We talk to Alana Furco every now and then. She is the manager of the Butte Plaza Mall up in Butte, Montana, and today is a check-in day. Alana, good to have you on again.
Happy spring, Kai.
So we had you on right after the election. You expressed, as a lot of people did back then, relief that the election was over. How are you feeling now?
You know, actually, I believe my stress level has increased considerably.
Oh.
You know, I'm going to say retail is kind of up and down, and I am very concerned at some of the things that are going on in politics.
Tell me how that plays out in the mall. I mean, what do you see on a Saturday afternoon when a lot of people, in theory, should be shopping, but now retail is having such a tough time?
Well, retail is having a tough time. And, you know, a reality of our life is e-commerce. I mean, it's very easy for people to order electronically, have it delivered in 1 to 2 days. We have suffered a couple bankruptcies, so we've lost some stores.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that is a reality. Retail is extremely liquid. We're playing it day by day.
Well, your JCPenney, I think, closed a couple of 3 years ago. Have you had anybody come in and take that side of the mall and get a new anchor tenant in there?
We have not, no. I still have two vacancies on my south end, and that's very concerning.
What about you? I mean, your job is to keep the Butte Plaza Mall up and running and full of people and full of shoppers and full of retailers selling their wares. How do you get by?
You know, it's challenging. Every day is a creative lesson in stress management. and right now we've got construction on the thoroughfare right outside our door. But since April, we've been stressing out because there have been times when we are completely choked off from traffic. Nobody can get in. Nobody can get out. That was pretty concerning for Mother's Day week. They did get everything opened up for us Friday night. You know, all the numbers aren't in, but I don't think that the weekend uptick was enough to bring our week up.
So this is going to sound like it's a little sideways, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway. We did a national economic poll a month or two ago, and 75% of the people that we talked to said that they think Washington, the government in Washington, has just forgotten about people like them. What's your answer to that same question? Do you think Washington has forgotten about people like you and the folks in Butte?
They have. You know, I think all of these millionaires and billionaires are so out of touch, not just with the middle class, but with every class beneath them. It is a worry. I'm worried for my kids' generation. I just hope that they have the opportunity to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. And
right.
And it is very concerning to see, you know, that the pinch to the middle class. I mean, we are the ones that shore them up at the bottom and keep things stable for the top. It is very concerning.
Alana Furco is the manager of the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. We talk to her every now and then, and we'll give you a call in a couple of 3 months, all right?
Okay, sir. You be well.
Help wanted. Big company, a long and proud history, proven yet vulnerable product demand, aging workforce in need of replenishment, outside work sometimes required, dogs occasionally a hazard. Good if you're a people person. Apply within at your local post office. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
30% of the Postal Service's approximately 640,000 workers are eligible to retire. 65-year-old Larry Anthony is one of them. He's a mail carrier in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is where I met him on a rainy May morning.
Got one more load to get, and I'll be right back.
Anthony loads up his mail truck for the day.
So, y'all ready to go?
And we head up.
Ta-da! So what do you want to know?
How long have you been with the Postal Service?
Ooh, too long. About 33 years.
And the job has changed a lot over the years, with less mail to deliver. So the Postal Service downsized, but it still has to deliver to almost every address in the country. So with fewer carriers, Anthony says, sometimes he has to work overtime.
It's like yesterday, we worked till 7:30. There were a shortage of clerks, so we had to work late. Today is also one of them. We have to work overtime today. Watch your step.
Still, Anthony says he loves the job. He likes the independence. He likes meeting people. He tries to talk up Postal Service work to millennials, but they focus on the rain, sleet, and snow part of the job, he tells them.
It's your attitude. Your attitude is everything. What about the days when it's 85 and perfect? Will you complain then? No. Everybody in the office building wants to be out where you are because they want what you've got.
Anthony is like a walking, talking recruiting ad for the Postal Service. Gerald Wilson is an actual recruiter. She's director of diversity and talent acquisition at the Postal Service. She goes to college fairs and says she has to sweet talk students into coming over to her booth.
I mean, because they'll kind of look at you out the side of their eye and I'll say, hey, I see you looking. Don't walk past me. Come on over. Come and talk to me. And I'm kind of cute. So they generally come over.
Wilson says when they come over, she tells them, hey, the Postal Service isn't just about delivering mail.
IT, supply management, accounting, marketing, sales, every skill set that you think of, there's probably someone in the Postal Service doing it.
And for years, Postal Service jobs have been a way into the middle class, says Cornell University professor Rick Geddes.
People generally have, I would say, a solid middle class life as postal workers. I think historically it has been a way out of the out of poverty.
But new Postal Service workers don't have quite the same benefits as older ones like Larry Anthony.
What's up, my friend? How you doing?
Now we're in a Silver Spring office building, clattering along behind Anthony's mail cart. He tells me he sent two of his kids to college on his Postal Service salary.
Yeah, the Postal Service, they do so take care of their carriers nicely, especially the older ones. Now, the newer ones, it's going to take them a while to get where we are.
Anthony says the Postal Service contributes less toward newer workers' retirement packages, and they have 401k-type plans. Anthony hopes to retire later this year, and he'll have a traditional pension, 80% of his final salary. In Silver Spring, Maryland, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I know I sometimes come off as grouchy in this segment, but I got nothing on Congressman Mark Walker of North Carolina's 6th District. The architect of the Capitol did something nice for the ducklings that inhabit the reflecting pool in front of the Capitol the other day. He built a little ramp for them so they could get up and over the big concrete edges of the pool and into the water because it's summertime, it's hot, and also they're tiny little ducklings, right? We got a picture on our website. It's pretty cute. Congressman Walker, though, is having none of it. If it looks like a duck, he tweeted today, and walks like a duck, it must be government waste. Bah, humbug. All right, we got to go. The Dow flat today, down just 2 points. NASDAQ added 0.3%, 20 points. New record high. S&P 500 gave back just under 0.1%, about a single point. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.